You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Since humans began to create societies, the quest for answers to the ultimate big question has dogged us forever. Regardless of our religious, philosophical, or personal belief systems, the proof of existence and evidence of the afterlife is seemingly hardwired into our DNA around the world. In his fourth book on this particular subject, The Case for the Afterlife, Evidence of Life After Death, author Chris Carter states his case for what really happens at the end. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. And you can click the link in the show notes too. Thank you to each and every one of you that support the show with your contributions. It is always greatly appreciated. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit our website at mysteriesandmonsters.com, and our exclusive merchandise site is available via TeePublic, and you will find the link for that in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. The one thing that we will always share in our life is that we will pass. But as Chris Carter explains, it most certainly is not the end. Since the earliest writings and communities, the concept of an afterlife has perplexed, perturbed, and persuaded many of the reality of such a state. In his latest book, The Case for the Afterlife, Chris Carter presents a thorough journey into the realization that there is a growing confirmation that this is not simply belief, it is a reality. Chris, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
It's an intriguing topic, Chris, in general, I think. It's one of those things, especially over the last 150 years, that you could kind of sort of draw a line in the modern era from the birth of modern spiritualism, as it were, in the acceptance of the modern world. But it's a fascinating topic that, as I said in the introduction, peoples have considered the concepts and the potential of travels beyond this mortal coil since the earliest dawn of time, really, even going back to the times of the Neanderthals, who would leave gifts in graves. And we can only look at how our perception of them as a people and as a community and as a culture has developed over this period, that we've gone from thinking that they were semi-animalistic hunter-gatherers to seeing that they were a real culture that had beliefs and families and protection and things like that, and obviously cross-pollinated into modern humans as we are, as we know that there are many people around the world that share some strands of Neanderthal DNA. Is it for you, as a man who has seemingly devoted a large portion of your life in recent decades, Chris, in this field, frustrating that for some this just seems to be nonsensical belief and fantasy for many?
Well, I'd argue there's nothing extraordinary about belief in an afterlife. As you said, it dates back at least to the Neanderthals, who left tools, jewelry, and utensils in the graves of their dead. Most people around the world accept at least the possibility, if not the reality, of the afterlife, and they always have. So there's nothing extraordinary about it. What we really have today, what we faced over the last perhaps 150 years, is this rise of the so-called skeptical movement. Now, it's important to remember that most of these so-called skeptics are actually militant atheists. Now, one of the fundamental pillars of the atheistic worldview is the ancient doctrine of materialism. This is the idea, the ancient idea, that all the events ultimately have a physical cause, and that therefore the brain produces the mind. Now, any evidence to the contrary directly is a direct attack upon this pillar of materialism, and thus threatens the collapse of the entire atheistic materialistic worldview. This fact, more than any other, I believe, explains their dogmatic, vehement, scorch the earth, denial of the evidence. It is so common among these materialists.
I've often been struck, Chris, when I've looked at numerous cases. I mean, poltergeists are a particular favourite of mine. And what I've often been surprised at and frustrated by is that often someone can basically just make a statement. And because they don't believe in the paranormal or the Fortean in whatever field it is, people seem to accept it. I'm not really sure why. And as I've often said, and as you alluded to there, skeptics will lie. If they can't explain something, they will ignore evidence that contradicts their point or undermines their point of view in regards to certain aspects. And this is one of these prime examples where they will simply put forward what they consider a rational explanation based on, I think, the aspect that the people who they are addressing wouldn't have the tools or the knowledge or the intellect to rebut these challenges to these kind of belief systems that they see.
That's interesting. I don't call them skeptics. I call them pseudo-skeptics. True skepticism is the practice of doubt.
Yes.
Not the practice of denial. These people are actually deniers. Same thing with climate change deniers. In other words, they've got a hidden agenda, an ideological agenda. In the case of the climate change deniers, of course, it's financial. Most of these people who are deniers are lobbyists for the oil and gas companies. And as I said earlier, most of these so-called skeptics of the so-called paranormal, of the evidence for survival and for extrasensory perception and what have you, they've also got a hidden agenda. As I said before, most of them are militant atheists. You mentioned lies. There was a book written by one of your colleagues, Will Storr, Englishman, and he wrote a book titled The Heretics, in which he interviewed various people that he considered heretics on both sides of the controversy. At one point, he interviewed James Randi, and he had, he had been interviewing people who've tangled with Randi in the past. One of them was a woman who had an enormous argument with him online, and he confronted Randi. He was granted an interview. And he said to Randi, I want to talk to you about your encounters with this woman. You were accusing her of telling lies, of being a liar, when it was you, Randi, who was telling the lies. And Randi merely said, well, that's not my recollection of the events. I remember it differently. And he held up a sheet of paper and he said, Will Storr, held up a sheet of paper and said, I have the emails. Randi at this point kind of slumped and he went, oh. And then he looked uncomfortable and he admitted that he was a liar. He said, yes, there can be lies. There can be untruths. I'm not sure if lies are always conscious, but yes, there can be mistruths. So Randi himself, I'm paraphrasing, of course, it was one of his exact words, but he did admit that he was a liar. And as you said before, some of these people are so desperate to dismiss the objectionable evidence that they will say absolutely anything in order to preserve their or defend their ideological preconceived beliefs.
Mm. I mean, Randi is a prime example of this because obviously there was always a lot of currency made of his $1 million prize for anybody that could prove him wrong. And I've spoken to people on both sides of the divide, as it were, Chris, who have categorically said that he would change the goalposts. If you met certain criteria, he would suddenly introduce something else that you needed to jump through. So he basically just kept moving the goalposts for people. Therefore, that's not the work of somebody who's a skeptic. That's somebody, as you say, is somebody who's an arch denier. They don't want it to be true. And if you prove them wrong, they'll go, well, yes, you can do this. But what about this? But hang on a minute, that's probably what we're not testing here.
Yeah, I got one more thing to say about Randi. Most people don't realize this. Paul, do you have any idea how many people he actually tested?
Like, I do not know.
Real test?
No.
The answer is zero. What he did, he had this trick that he used. He always insisted first upon a preliminary test. Mm-hmm. And he never let anyone pass the preliminary test. And he was even quoted as saying, "I always have an out." In other words, he always had a way of avoiding putting anyone through a test in which the money was actually on the line. Some people doubt that the $1 million actually even existed. Mm. Randy's been sued successfully numerous times because of his many outrageous accusations. At one point, he was begging his followers to send him money because of his desperate financial straits. So what I'm trying to say is his so-called $1 million challenge was really, it was laughable. Mm. And at any rate, even the more sophisticated skeptics such as Ray Hyman, they didn't take this challenge seriously. That's not how science operates, with challenges and prizes. Science operates with peer-reviewed research, which should be replicated, or at least is capable of being replicated. Randy was ultimately a lightweight and should never have been taken seriously. Just a showman.
Yes. Well, precisely. He was an extreme self-publicist, I think is one of the best titles you could give him. And, I've read a lot and I've seen numerous interviews with him and the documentary that was done towards the end of his life in regards to that. And there are some very strange moments in that where you can kind of see the veneer of the public persona falls away sometimes. And what you see is not what the general public would have known him as. It's interesting to see that. But like you say, I think because certain people have this wonderful ability of being able to manipulate the media in a certain way, and one would say someone like Randy would be very good at it as a magician, as someone who's used to performing to the public, his stance in regards to this particular field was simply a performance, was it not, Chris?
It's important to remember that these people are not interested in getting at the truth. They're not interested in genuine investigation, although they may make those claims, but they're not. They're interested in essentially defending their own worldview and dismissing any challenges to that worldview. In my first book, which was originally titled Parapsychology and the Skeptics, I discuss in great detail the history of the so-called skeptical movement and the history and practice and membership of the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. I discussed in further detail the Star Baby scandal. That was a scandal that was reported by somebody who defected from PsyCop. At one point, I quote one of the original editors of their journal, The Skeptical Inquirer, and I can't remember the exact quote, so again, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something along the lines of, "The purpose of the magazine is not to carefully investigate claims of the paranormal, but to argue against them." In other words, the contribution of that magazine is pure polemic rhetoric.
Well, it also goes against what science is based on. It's testing and trying to repeat things to get to the correct decision or realizing that what you are testing for that is a possibility. If you dismiss it out of hand, that goes against it. And especially when you look at certain scientific disciplines, archaeology and biology are two prime examples of knowledge is extremely malleable, because the more we learn, it changes our perceptions of the past. And we see this on a constant loop, it would seem. And so when we look at these kind of aspects of the mind and the brain and the possibilities of the potential for super ESP or the paranormal or psychic phenomenon, how we use our knowledge of the brain and our bodies and how it works has come on leaps and bounds in the last century. But we still know, in the great scheme of things, very little in how our bodies work. And in regards, even like you mentioned in the book, the senses we take so for granted, and yet the reality is we're not really sure how they work still.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we know about the universe is dwarfed by what we don't know about the universe. There's an interesting book that was written by two physicists. It came out a few years ago. It's titled We have no idea. Now, most books, most popularizing books on science, they focus on what we do know, what we do know about the universe, its size, the number of galaxies, you know, and so forth. This book takes exactly the opposite approach and discusses what we don't know. Every single chapter is devoted to a different topic that of which we have no idea. So, yeah, it turns out that what we know a great deal about very little. What we don't know vastly exceeds what little that we do know or think we know. I just want to like to add something here. I mentioned Skeptical Inquirer magazine. Kendrick Fraser was the original editor, and a fellow named Henry Bauer wrote in the Journal of Scientific Explanation an exchange of letters with Kendrick Fraser in which the Skeptical Inquirer's editor argued that, and here's a quote, "The magazine's purpose is not to consider what the best evidence for anomalous claims might be, but to argue against them." Those are actually Henry Bauer's words. So yeah, there's another fellow, another woman actually, Elizabeth Meyer. She was a psychologist who wrote a book called Extraordinary Knowing shortly before she died. And this is from my first book, Science. It was renamed. It was originally released as Parapsychology and the Skeptics. My original publisher actually went out of business. They closed down shop. It was taken over by a new publisher. They changed the name to Science and Psychic Phenomena. This is something written by a skeptic, Elizabeth Meyer. She described how she began investigating psi phenomena. Here's a quote from her book. I had high hopes for what PsyCop's journal might provide. At the very least, it would, I thought, offer useful balance to journals with a clear bent toward belief in the paranormal. I was particularly enthused about the Skeptical Inquirer's policy of reviewing research on anomalous mental capacities published elsewhere. I figured that PsyCop would help me come up with useful challenges to articles written from the more credulous side. But it didn't work that way. Reading the Skeptical Inquirer was like reading a fundamentalist religious tract. I found the journal dismayingly snide, regularly punctuated by sarcasm, self-congratulation, and nastiness, all parading as reverence for true science. Mm-hmm. It was Elizabeth Myers from her book, Extraordinary Knowing.
Yeah. I suppose, Chris, what was it that set you off on this journey of exploration in this particular field? Because obviously you're a university-educated man. You've travelled around the world, which I would imagine also helps in regards to this particular subject, because one can only look at how certain Eastern cultures and belief systems seem to treat this subject far more as reality than say, Western religious situations or Western culture does. You can travel around the world, and for many the discussion in regards to an afterlife and reincarnation and the belief in supernatural power is a given for many, and yet here in the modern world, as it were, the home of the Industrial Revolution, we still, even though we have areas that are incredibly religious, once again, it seems to be a very sort of dogmatic approach to these kind of systems. Whereas I think sometimes you become more enlightened by speaking to people outside of that framework.
Well, surveys show that most people in most countries either believe in the reality of an afterlife or are open to the possibility, whether they're religious or not. Well, it started during my university days when I was going to school in England, and one evening, a friend of mine, we were in our college dormitory, and it was during our first year, and he was asking me if I was be interested in spending our next year living in a farmhouse owned by our college, which lay just outside of town. And I was hesitant. I was an expatriate, and I didn't really know if I wanted to leave the college dormitory, which was much closer to town and college. But he was persistent, and he looked at me and he said, "The place has a ghost." And I thought, I was a little... His words caught my attention. I said, "Well, has anyone seen anything?" And he said, "No, but there's been a lot of strange sounds reported." So I decided to see the place for myself. It turned out to be a large two-story stone medieval farmhouse. nice enough place. While I was there, I stopped in to speak with the college carpenter who had his workshop on the property. And after a brief chat, I came straight out with it. I said, I hear the place is haunted. And he said, well, I don't know myself, but the carpenter before me, he swore the place was haunted. And that was enough for me. I decided to move in the following fall and spend the next year living in this ancient farmhouse. To make a long story short, I did see and hear things which I could not readily explain, things which were not consistent with the materialist opinions of some of the philosophers I'd studied. But I was open-minded enough to concede that perhaps these experiences were of just what they seemed, the lingering disembodied presence of someone who'd lived in the house in days long past. In other words, these strange experiences, which were not particularly dramatic, they sparked my interest. They didn't convince me. But after I returned to my own country, I began to wonder if any serious research had been done on these topics. So I visited a local library, and I was surprised by the enormous volume of research that had been done on the subject over the past 100, 150 years. Particularly impressive was the research done by the British and American Societies for Psychical Research, which were both founded in the 1880s. I mean, despite the often repeated lie that the British and American Societies for Psychical Research never found anything, the simple fact of the matter remains is that by the early years of the 20th century, the evidence was so strong, the evidence that these people had gathered was so strong that virtually all of the members, which included some of the finest scientists, philosophers, physicians, lawyers, and scholars on both sides of the Atlantic, the evidence was strong enough by the early 20th century to convince most of them, almost all of them, that of the reality of an afterlife. And this was true even of those members who started off as diehard skeptics, such as the lawyer Richard Hodgson, who started off determined to debunk mediums. Well, Hodgson eventually, through his investigation of the Boston medium Lenora Piper, he eventually became convinced that his departed friend, the lawyer George Pellew, who had died in an accident at the age of 32, was communicating through Miss Piper. And the evidence was strong enough to convince even dozens of Pellew's surviving friends and relatives that they were indeed conversing with their departed friend George. So yes, both were founded in the 1880s. The British Society was founded in 1882 with Henry Sidgwick, philosopher at Cambridge University as his first president. 2 years later, in 1884, the American Society was founded with William James, a philosopher at Harvard, as his first president. And these two societies on both sides of the Atlantic, they often cooperated, shared data. They gathered an enormous volume of extremely high-quality research.
It's surprising. I think sometimes when we talk about the birth of both societies, I think people just presumed it was men in smoky rooms who just fancied setting up a club of some description. But as you say there, Chris, these were extremely learned people that were intrigued, confused about the possibilities that were going on.
Yes, often skeptical in a genuine sense as well.
Mm. And so they kind of made it their sort of life's work to delve into these things. And like you say, some of the early cases that they worked on are incredible on both sides of the Atlantic. And as you say, I think even the most ardent of disbelievers who may have been part of both movements at the time, by the turn of the century, they would, you know, there's very little that they could kind of say in regards to this, because often people are always on about it's trickery. And it always amazes me the amount of children, especially in haunting cases, who are often prescribed skills and abilities that would make them world-class stage magicians, and yet they just seem to be run-of-the-mill people of a variety of backgrounds, often working class, it would seem, who seem to find themselves in the middle of extraordinary events and often feel completely bereft of assistance from anybody that they would consider it as a support network or someone that could come and help them, until these societies came along and treated them with the respect that their experiences and situations required.
Yeah. When the British and American Society of Psychical Research originally founded, they started off investigating both physical mediums and mental mediums. Now, physical mediums are the ones that many people think of when they think of mediumship, the ones that are alleged to make tables float or make musical instruments play by themselves or even produce apparitions on demand and so forth. And they quickly abandoned their research into physical mediumship for a few reasons. One reason was they exposed several fraudulent physical mediums. Hmm. And the other reason is that they realized it was just too easy to dismiss even the best reports of physical mediumship on the grounds that it was due to mistaken eyewitness testimony or exaggeration or outright fraud. And so they concentrated their effort instead on what are known as mental mediums. Mental mediums do not produce any physical phenomena apart from speaking and writing. Hmm. These are usually women who will seem to go into a trance, and they'll relay information seemingly coming from the departed in different ways. Some will go into a trance and they'll relay verbally what they say is a departed person speaking to them. Others will have a pencil or a pen, piece of paper put in front of them, and they'll begin to write, often very rapidly. The sheets will have to be removed and replaced. They'll answer questions in writing, often very rapidly. They'll write entire essays. And in the most dramatic cases of so-called possession mediumship, the medium's body, their vocal cords, their hand seems to be taken over or possessed by the spirit, the soul, the mind, the consciousness, whatever you want to call it, of the departed person who seems to be communicating. And it's also important to remember that with very few exceptions, most of the mediums studied by the British and American societies were not professional mediums. Most of them were women of high social standing, well-educated. One of them, Mrs. Verrill, was a lecturer at Cambridge University. Another, Miss Coombe Tennant, was the first British ambassador, or the British, the first woman ambassador to the League of Nations, the precursor to the modern United Nations. Mm. Most of these women they were not paid for their services, and they did not want their work publicized. When their work was published in the British and American journals, they were referred to by pseudonyms. Not their original names. These were, again, women of high social standing, often married to politicians, to physicians, and they operated under pseudonyms. There was only one exception I mentioned earlier, Miss Piper, Lenora Piper of Boston University. She started off as a professional medium. Her talents were discovered by the American Society, and after investigating her, having her trailed with private detectives and so forth, realizing that she seemed gave every indication of being the real deal, they put her on the payroll of the American Society so that she could be studied full time. That was the sole exception to the rule. All the others were non-professional mediums, and it was through the study of this Miss Lenora Piper that the skeptical lawyer Richard Hodgson, the very hard-headed fellow, came to have been convinced the reality of his friend George Pellew, deceased George Pellew, communicating through her.
Do you think that's one of the aspects that frustrates people sometimes, is that when they use the term medium, they don't tend to separate them out into the two clear strands of that particular talent, one could say, as you say, because it's very easy. And that period of history is littered, as you refer to, with so many frauds. I mean, some of them are quite amusing, I have to say, when I've looked at them. I always forget their names, but there was a pair of brothers from America who could only perform if they were locked in a box. And they came to the UK on tour, and it didn't go down very well, Chris. And their box was smashed up, and they were sent home from Liverpool with their tails between their legs, because the locals were not very impressed with this sleight of hand trick. Whereas I think sometimes when you look at that, a lot of people can't pull them apart. They use the term medium as a group all, and therefore, if you can dismiss such cases as that, and as I say, there are countless examples in the latter 19th century and into the 20th century. They all seem to, it seems to be a catch-all term, whereas once you look at individual cases in the reports and the studies done by the organisations, it's quite clear that there's something very different going on both strands.
Yeah. I want to read you a quote by, I mentioned Richard Hodgson several times now, and how he became convinced that his friend was communicating for him. This is what Hodgson finally admitted. I'm quoting him right now. "I had but one object, to discover fraud and trickery. Frankly, I went to Mrs. Piper with Professor James of Harvard University about 12 years ago with the object of unmasking her. I entered the house profoundly materialistic, not believing in the continuance of life after death. Today, I say I believe. The truth has been given to me in such a way as to remove from me the possibility of doubt." So those are the words of arch-skeptic, hard-minded, hard-headed investigator Richard Hodgson.
I think one of the most striking cases you refer to in this book, Chris, is this chess game. Primarily because the one thing that surprised me was I didn't know Russell Targ was related to Bobby Fischer through marriage. I mean, Fischer is one of those, anybody knows anything about chess in the latter part of the 20th century, Fischer is one of those names that is synonymous with sort of a rock and roll attitude to it. He was a bit of a rock star grandmaster. He was a very intriguing and interesting person. And he ends up being involved in this incredible case of a chess game that seems to be played in the afterlife. And it is remarkable, primarily not just because we're talking about the potential of a game of chess at a very high level, because this is the other aspect. This is not, as someone that can play the game, Chris, I would not consider myself to be anything above an intermediate at best from my time at being chess club at school. But this game was studied. They used computers to kind of try and recreate the moves as if the medium was fraudulently trying to pull the wool over their eyes. And when you come to the end of it and you look at the input of the people who can play the game at grandmaster level, it is astounding, is it not?
Yeah, you're referring to the case I discuss in depth, a chess match, test game between a deceased grandmaster and a living grandmaster. Yeah, that was initiated in 1985 when Dr. Wolfgang Eisenbeiss decided to initiate a chess match between living and deceased grandmasters. So he contacted the amateur medium, Robert Rollins, who worked as a musician. He always offered his services free of charge. And he asked Rollins to find a deceased grandmaster who'd be willing to play. And so eventually, the Hungarian chess master Géza Maroczi agreed to play. And he was ranked third in the world in 1900 and was known for his remarkably strong game. He then looked for a living grandmaster to be willing to play, and he found Viktor Korchnoi. He was then ranked third in the world. This was 1985. So Korchnoi was described in Chess Base, the magazine, as, I'm quoting here, unquestionably one of the great chess players of all time. So Maroczi communicated, there's much more than a mere chess game. He wrote, these are the words that came through the medium Robert Rollins, apparently from Géza Maroczi. "I will be at your disposal in this peculiar game of chess for two reasons. First, because I also want to do something to aid mankind living on Earth, to become convinced that death does not end everything, but instead the mind is separated from the physical body and comes up to us in a new world where individual life continues to manifest itself in a new unknown dimension. Second, being a Hungarian patriot, I want to guide the eyes of the world into the direction of my beloved Hungary. Both of these items have convinced me to participate in that game with the thought of being at everyone's service. Now, at the 27th move, Korchnoi commented on the quality of his opponent's play, which was Rollins was the intermediary. This is what Korchnoi said. During the opening phase, Moroxy showed weakness. His play is old-fashioned. But I must confess that my last moves have not been too convincing. I am not sure I will win. He has compensated the faults of the opening by a very strong endgame. In the endgame, the ability of a player shows up and my opponent plays very well. Now, the only criticism of Moroxy's game that Korchnoi had was that his opening was old-fashioned. He seemed to have opened the game with an opening which is no longer used and no longer taught, because chess theory had made enormous advances since 1900. But after that, Korchnoi seems to have played almost perfect chess. Anyway, the entire match was recorded and transcribed, and I've got it went to 52 moves before, Moroxy eventually resigned. And you mentioned Bobby Fischer. So Bobby Fischer was sent the record of the game by the physicist Russell Targ with the intention of getting Fischer's opinion of the quality of the play. And this is what Russell Targ wrote. I sent the reported final chess score to Bobby Fischer, who, as I mentioned earlier, lived in Iceland, having been rescued from a Japanese jail by the kindness of the Icelandic government. Bobby wrote to me saying that, and here's the quote, anyone who can go 52 moves with Viktor Korchnoi is playing at a grandmaster level.
Which I suppose, at the end of the day, you would say, Chris, when you have a situation like that, you can only go to the expert in that particular field, regardless of the fact that we're talking about a game played on two different planes of existence, one would suggest. Unless you have somebody in the skeptical movement who is a chess grandmaster, they have no insight to that kind of talent, because it would be very easy for someone outside of the world of chess to dismiss this as a hoax, or that the medium was cheating. But clearly that was impossible, because even at that period in time, people would say, oh, well, there were computers and chess programs around, he could have used one of those. But as you say, chess is one of those things that when you immerse yourself in it, you realize that for the majority of people who don't know that much about it, they just think the game has never evolved and it doesn't change. And like you say, there are trends and styles and periods where the game is played very differently and it's taught differently all around the world. The board and the pieces are the same, but the way the game is played can vary dramatically. And having someone of Fischer's skill and talent would be the only real sort of confirmation of the abilities of the people that were involved in this particular game.
Yeah. Some of the skeptics will sometimes say that, well, you know, Robert Rollins used a computer, used computer software, chess playing software in order to fake the game. But that can be rejected on a number of grounds. First of all, I said before that Moroxy is an old fashioned opening, which is, it simply isn't taught anymore. Chess theory made enormous strides, advancements, especially in the opening of the game since 1900. And the other thing is the game was tried, or at least the game was played. It was a fellow named Nepi, I forget it. Viktor Nepi, I think his name is. I can't remember his name. But he was a former South African chess champion. And he set the program to respond to Korchnoi's moves. And he compared the computer's choices with those of Moroxy. And he wrote, Moroxy played human-type moves, and the computer simulation played computer-type moves, correcting what it thought were inferior moves. Moroxy clearly played the endgame far better than the computer. So the differences in style between an accomplished chess player and even the most remarkable computer program are they're extremely marked. And that's not only Nepi's opinion, because there was a philosopher and chess enthusiast named Tim McGrew of Michigan University And he independently of this case analyzed the ability of computers to play chess. And he wrote this in the late 20th century. Barring a conceptual breakthrough, the computer chess is and will remain detectably inhuman. So in other words, there's no way that Rollins could have used a computer to take on Korchnoi. There simply is no rational explanation other than the participation of Meroxy, the departed Meroxy, in this game. I go through all the standard objections, and they're ludicrous in the end.
Mm. Well, like I say, I think anybody who has any knowledge of the game knows it. If you're faking it in chess and you're playing somebody of that level, you get found out very, very, very quickly, and it wouldn't have gone anywhere near 52 moves.
Well, I mean, I've, we're just scratching the surface here. I've got an awful lot. I wrote an awful lot about the case between about this chess game between living and deceased grandmasters. But yes, I agree with you. That is one of the most convincing cases for a number of reasons.
I suppose when we look at this particular subject, often another thing that tends to get meshed together is near-death experience and out-of-body experience, Chris. And sometimes you will speak to people who seem to think that they're both the same. And yet, when you look at the experiences and the people who are involved in them, they are very different things that seem to affect different senses and leave the person involved with very different feelings often. I've recently talked about near-death experiences on another show, and some of those aspects of how people's lives change after they've experienced one is quite remarkable, in regards to that they seem to become more risk friendly. They tend to seem to act as if they don't care about living anymore, as because they've had a sighting, some kind of confirmation that it's not the end when you pass. There is something else regardless. And so for them, it's almost as if they just went, well, it doesn't really matter what I do here now, because I know I'm going to go on. And so those kinds of cases I find really quite remarkable, because they affected some of the most well-known people of 20th century in philosophy and literature. Hemingway and Freud and others have been involved in such situations. And yet sometimes those kind of get immersed into out-of-body experiences, which seem to be very different because they're usually in very different situations.
Well, the near-death experience has several aspects. The out-of-body experience is sometimes often one aspect of the near-death experience that is reported. Not always, but frequently. This is in cases in which the person is clinically dead, and they report later that they left their body and they observed the resuscitation scene from a position above near the ceiling. So the out-of-body experience is one aspect of the near-death experience, which is frequently reported, but not always. The near-death experience proves false the idea that the brain produces the mind, because many of these experiences are reported and give every indication of having occurred during a time when there's every medical reason to believe that the person's brain was either severely impaired or entirely non-functioning. I mean, there are several cases on record of occurring at a time when the person was clinically dead. Now, clinical death basically has three criteria: no spontaneous breathing, no heartbeat, and fixed dilated pupils, indicating that no activity in the brainstem, probably the most primitive part of our brain, which we share with crocodiles. So, and yet people report conscious experiences and perception of the surrounding environment during these times. I mention a few such cases in my book, the Pam Reynolds experience, mm-hmm. and a few others. These experiences occurred when these people were hooked up to sophisticated medical instruments monitoring the functions of their bodies.
I mean, the Pam Reynolds case, I remember hearing her speak about it, I don't know, 20 odd years ago. It's incredible, really. Because I think she was clinically dead for, I don't know, 20, 25, 30 minutes. And seems to have a series of recollections that explaining them away, I think, would be grasping at straws, Chris, because they are remarkable in regards to what she remembered in regards to the reality of what was happening to her physically at the same time. I know people say, oh, well, maybe she wasn't, maybe all the doctors and the machines weren't working properly and they weren't registering, or she could still hear things and therefore she remembered it. But there's little things about that particular case that she's able to look at things that she couldn't have possibly seen where she was, and she wouldn't have had any sort of indication or insight to them, even coming in or out of the theater.
But one of the surgeons who operated on her was Carl Green, and he was interviewed later about this case. And the way they brought her back was interesting. Essentially, what they had, in order to remove an aneurysm, which was deep inside her brain, near the brainstem, they had to literally kill her, induce clinical death by stopping her heart, by draining her head with blood. Essentially, she was clinically dead, and yet she reported one of the deepest near-death experiences ever. Now, when they brought her back, and Pam remembers watching this from above, they needed to apply electrical shocks to her heart. But sometimes one shock will restart the heart. Sometimes two it requires, sometimes three. In this case, they required two. Now, Pam remembered that little detail, that it wasn't one shock that brought her back. It wasn't three. It was two, exactly. And as I said, one of the surgeons was interviewed later on about the operation. And this is what he said. These are his words. She, that is Pam Reynolds, she knew her heart had to be stimulated twice to restart. She shouldn't have known that. She was physiologically dead. No brainwave activity, no heartbeat, nothing. No blood inside her body of any consequence. She was dead. And Pam Reynolds was interviewed on CBS program 48 Hours, along with Dr. Spetzler, the head surgeon. And he left no doubt about Pam's clinical condition during what's known as hypothermic cardiac arrest. That's where they essentially induced clinical death. Hmm. This is what Spetzler said on camera. If you would examine that patient from a clinical perspective during that hour, that patient is by all definition would be dead. At this point, there is no brain activity, no blood going through the brain, nothing, nothing, nothing. And then later on in the program, he admitted this. I don't have an explanation for it. I don't know how it's possible for it to happen, considering her physiological state she was in. At the same time, I've seen so many things that I can't explain that I don't want to be so arrogant as to be able to say that there's no way it can happen. Now, again, this is one of the deepest NDAs that ever happened. It happened in an operating theater during a time in which Pam was, without question, without any rational question, clinically dead. No heartbeat, no blood in her brain. She was dead. And yet she reported one of the deepest near-death experiences ever.
Well, exactly. It's not like she'd gone in for a standard operation and had gone into cardiac arrest during it, because an aneurysm is a life-threatening ailment. I believe Pam, essentially, she just had a massive bag of blood at the back of her head, didn't she?
Yeah, well, it's a desperate situation that called for desperate measures. As mm-hmm. I said before, the physicians had to literally kill her, had to induce clinical death in the operating theater. There's one other thing I'd like to add, Paul, is that in this book, The Case for the Afterlife, I consider much more than just the near-death experience. I consider evidence from five independent lines of evidence: deathbed visions, the near-death experience, apparitions, children who claim to remember a previous life, and seeming communication from the departed via human mediums. Five independent lines of evidence, and they all point in the same direction.
I mean, I've always been fascinated with deathbed visions, Chris, where having had the, as many people have had, the misfortune of seeing a beloved member of the family seemingly travelling towards the end, as it were. The one thing that's always struck me on occasions, not all the time, but I've certainly seen it more than once, is that there seems to become a lucidity to these people in the final days, hours, where they may have been really struggling previously or not responding as well to stimuli as would often be. Conversations could be stunted or non-existent often. And it's almost as if the impending end seems to sort of revitalize them. And sometimes you will have, I'm speaking once again from personal experience, people who claim to be either see or communicate with people who have passed on previously as almost as if they're part of a welcoming group that have come to visit them wherever they may be it a hospital, a home, or a hospice, Chris.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. We talked earlier about the mind-body problem, the relationship between the mind and the brain. Mm. I think that all of the evidence indicates that the relationship between, that the brain operates as a receiver transmitter, a two-way receiver transmitter for the mind. It doesn't produce the brain, rather it receives and transmits consciousness. So a two-way receiver transmitter, sometimes from body to mind, as in sense perception, other times from mind to body, as in willed action. And you raised another important point. It's not necessary to invoke the so-called paranormal, near-death experiences, apparitions, and so forth, in order to establish this, that the relationship between the mind and the brain is that the brain acts as a receiver transmitter for the mind. You mentioned the well-known medical phenomenon referred to as terminal lucidity. Mm. Now, these are cases in which someone with severe brain damage, whether due to disease or injury, suddenly, after years of being little more than a babbling person or even a vegetable in some cases, suddenly seems to regain normal consciousness in the final days, hours, or minutes of their lives. This is well known among people who work with the dead, nurses, physicians, and so forth. And it's been known since ancient times. I mean, Hippocrates wrote about it, Plutarch, Cicero. They all noted how normal consciousness seems to reappear in the final moments of life. And what they concluded it was the mind disengaging from the restrictions of a damaged material brain in the final moments of physical life.
It's almost as if it was freeing itself from the shackles of physicality then.
Yeah. There was a woman, fairly recent case about, it's involved an elderly woman suffering from Alzheimer's. Mm. And the medical people, let's see here. Yeah, the researchers determined that this was largely caused by degeneration and irreversible degradation of the cerebral cortex and the hippocampus, resulting among other symptoms in confusion, disorientation, and memory loss. Now, she hadn't talked with family members for years. And 1 week before she died, the nurse called her granddaughter in because she suddenly seemed normal. And she chatted with her granddaughter about various family members and giving her advice. And her granddaughter said that it was like talking to someone who had been asleep for 20 years. Hmm. So again, this is a well-known medical phenomenon. It's not necessary to invoke near-death experience or apparitions or anything like that in order to provide solid reasons for believing that the mind is not produced by the brain. Mm. And incidentally, this was the opinion of Sir John Eccles, who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology for discovering how brain cells, neurons, communicate. They do it with chemicals he referred to as neurotransmitters, which cross the synaptic gap, the gap between the synapses of adjacent neurons. He thought that the brain was the instrument of the mind. Wilder Penfield, the famous Canadian brain surgeon who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work with epileptic patients, he started off trying to discover how the brain produces the mind. He eventually concluded exactly the opposite. He thought that the relationship between the mind and the brain was that of programmer to computer. In other words, he thought the brain was a sort of biological computer which was programmed to handle mundane tasks by a conscious mind. And we've all experienced this sort of thing. I mean, think about trying to learn, way back when, trying to learn how to drive a car. I mean, it took a lot of conscious effort. We had to think about everything, you know, how to shift the gears, you know, signaling before we turn lanes and so forth. But after we've done it for a while, these things become virtually automatic. And we may have had the experience of, well, we're driving to a friend's place or what have you, some place that we normally don't go. And we're thinking about something else. We find ourselves driving to work or driving to the grocery store. Why? Because we've programmed our brains in order to perform these tasks automatically and on automatic pilots, as it were. Or think about learning how to play a musical instrument. At the beginning, we have to think about everything very carefully, our finger placement and so forth. But after we've been doing it for a while, these mundane tasks are allocated to the brain, which frees our conscious mind in order to think about how we want the music to sound. What speed do we want to play it with? How do we want to emphasize various notes and so forth? Or learning to play a new sport. At the beginning, we have to think about everything, but later on, we can make the shot automatically and execute the shot more or less automatically, and we can instead think about matters of tactics. Where do we want to place the shot? It is not necessary to invoke the so-called paranormal in order to provide solid reasons for thinking that the brain is the instrument of the mind and does not produce the mind.
I think what's also striking when we have this sort of terminal lucidity as well, Chris, is often one of the arguments against such things is that, oh, well, it they're the same all the time. And I know of two personal cases where they're very different. One was quite sudden and it happened really towards the end. And the other seemed like a week-long build-up where it seemed that people were visiting on a day-to-day basis. And it just settled it all into the final week. And so when I looked at both of those, I thought, well, these are very different responses to something that's supposed to be the same signal or chemical being released in the brain. And I didn't understand how you could dismiss them, because they were clearly, whilst the only sort of constant in those was that there was someone who was terminally ill at that moment in time. But both of their experiences of that lucidity were very, very different.
Yeah, no two cases in any of the five lines of evidence I consider are the same. There's always, individual differences. But, of course, there's various common factors. In the near-death experience, for example, people report feelings of peace and joy, a feeling of having died, perceptions from outside of their bodies, meeting a mysterious being of light who takes them on a life review, sometimes meeting departed friends and relatives, sometimes meeting religious figures. So no two experiences are exactly the same, and not all near-death experiences have exactly the same features. Some do not have perception of the immediate environment. Some do not involve meeting deceased friends and relatives, but they all seem to be life-altering experiences, pivotal moments in these people's lives, sometimes very much changing them as people. People switch careers. There was one fellow, he was a successful businessman, very much concerned, very ruthless, very materialistic in the sense that he enjoyed expensive cars and so forth. He became a philanthropist. He just reversed his course, and I saw a documentary, and he said that his new life is much richer than the life that he had before. He completely changed as a person. It's not uncommon. These are life-altering experiences.
Absolutely. This is the other thing as well. Often, especially in the modern era, the perception of messages or communication with the other side seems to have taken a darker path, which I think is down to once again, the bias of the people dealing with it, because regardless of, as we were saying about skeptics, you also have the opposite effect where certain believers will say, this is the reason this is happening. And often it's based in their religious bias or their upbringing, Chris. And so they too will have a slant on it that may go against this overall impression, because the general consensus, and as shown in this book and your previous work, is that these rules don't apply to your religious beliefs. It is a matter of fact that these people have these experiences regardless of their belief system, even to the point of humanists and atheists.
Yeah, I agree with you. Sometimes the interpretation may be different, but yeah, the core of the experience is usually the same. It also has to be remembered that several of the members of the British and American Society of Psychical Research were clergymen or theologians. And some of them were active researchers who investigated mediums. One of them was the Reverend Charles Drayton Thomas. He was a Methodist minister, and he was an active member of the British Society of Psychical Research. He participated in many sittings with mediums. And he wrote, this is a quote from, he wrote, "Perhaps it will be asked what benefit may be expected from a general acceptance of this evidence for survival. I think it will do for others what it has done for me. It has supplemented and reinforced my faith, both in times of bereavement and in the prospect of old age and death. Also, it has further emphasized the value of personal religion." The Catholic Church, there's evidence their opinion is changing. The Church of England Committee thoroughly studied reports of mediumship and determined, this was their conclusion, "The hypothesis that they," that is the spirit communications, "proceed in some cases from discarnate spirits is the true one." So there's no conflict between religious belief and the evidence for survival. I would argue that the evidence for survival supplements and reinforces the words of the ancients.
Do you think this is also wrapped up in this human fear of death as well, Chris? That a lot of people, it's one of those conversations that people just don't like to talk about it. And I think when you delve into this particular subject, for a lot of people who are afraid of passing or just going, and that's it, it's the end, it changes their perception on their place in the world, and it gives them a bit more comfort. It kind of, as we were saying about the mind and the brain being separate to each other rather than one being entirely in, the brain being in charge of the mind and such like, this enables people to be free of this fear of death, because it is pervasive in all aspects of our life, this constant live while you can, it seize the moment and all this. Whereas when you take a step back and look at it, and as you were saying about how people's lives change when they have a near-death experience or an out-of-body experience or go through a trauma that changes the direction of where they're heading, it seems to allow people to really live then.
Yes, these experiences change people for the better. And I also think that coming to realize that belief in the reality of an afterlife is not ultimately a question of faith. It's a question of evidence, and it can be very strongly defended purely on the basis of evidence.
In regards to this is the fourth book in this series that you've built upon, and some of the ideas and theories and things that you've discussed. Would you consider this a full stop to this body of work now, Chris? Do you think you've said everything you need to say, or do you always have that sort of get out of jail card in the back pocket just in case down the line something else occurs? You think this now is the argument. You've disproved numerous skeptical arguments against these experiences across the world. For you, case closed.
Well, I have to remember, Paul, that I argue in this book that the case for the afterlife can be proven beyond all reasonable doubt. There's an essay that interested listeners can find on my publisher's website, Llewellyn. They can just go to my publisher's website, and on this site, they can read a description of the book. They can read endorsements from leading individuals in the field. And they can also read an essay that I wrote for my publisher, a short essay summarizing my ideas, and the essay is simply titled, Can We Prove the Reality of Life After Death? And I argue that we can, but we have to be careful about what we mean by proof, because there's different standards of proof. There's proof beyond all reasonable doubt, and there's proof beyond all conceivable doubt. And I argue in my book that proof beyond a conceivable doubt does not apply. It should not be applied to factual matters. What do I mean by proof beyond all conceivable doubt? Well, here's a simple example that's probably familiar to everybody. If A is greater than B, and B is greater than C, then A must be greater than C. It is simply inconceivable to our minds that C is greater than A. But the only reason we can attain such mathematical certainty is because A, B, and C are purely abstract entities in a purely abstract argument. Once we leave the realm of pure logic and pure mathematics, proof beyond all conceivable doubt simply does not apply. It's only proof beyond all reasonable doubt. Now, what do I mean by that? I argue that a statement is proven beyond all reasonable doubt. We have good reason to believe it's true, or good reasons to believe it is true, and no good reason to believe that the statement may be false. And when we're dealing with factual matters, all good reasons are ultimately reasons that are grounded upon evidence, not speculation. This is why in a court of law, the prosecution is required to prove guilt beyond all reasonable doubt, not beyond all conceivable doubt. And this is why speculative arguments from the defense and the prosecution are simply not allowed, because speculative arguments raise the standard of proof from beyond all reasonable doubt to beyond all conceivable doubt. Because we can always imagine the possibility that the police detectives framed the person accused of murder or what have you. But unless the defense presents evidence that in this particular case, the police detectives actually did frame his or her client, then the argument simply is not allowed in court, because speculative arguments, again, raise the burden of proof from beyond all reasonable doubt to beyond all conceivable doubt. The so-called skeptics of the evidence, which I present in my four books, they no longer argue on the basis of reasonable doubt. They're now reduced to raising conceivable doubt, purely abstract, purely speculative objections. This is the reason why my book is divided into three parts, parts one, two, and three. Part one is simply titled The Toolkit, and it deals with the distinction between proof beyond all reasonable doubt, proof beyond all conceivable doubt, the reliability of eyewitness testimony, the nature of evidence, and so forth. And these tools are then used in part two to evaluate both the evidence and the so-called skeptical objections to the evidence. In part three, I wrap it all up in a section titled Rest in Peace, Super ESP. And I finally lay that fantastic so-called skeptical objection to rest. That's the idea that these mediums possess these vast, virtually unlimited powers of telepathy and clairvoyance in order to instantly gather information from the minds of living people, regardless of what those people are thinking about, or instantly and clairvoyantly gather information from books and other books and what have you, locations around the world, regardless of whether or not those published materials are even known to the medium. And I argue that the evidence indicates that this explanation simply should not be taken seriously. There are cases in which, including the chess case we mentioned and the case of George Pellew, where the predictions of living agent extrasensory perception are proven false by the evidence. You get exactly the opposite of what you'd expect if the medium was unconsciously employing these vast powers in order to deceive the sitter and her own conscious mind. So it's been proven false, and as I said, the skeptics are reduced to the point where they're putting forth these elaborate, purely speculative scenarios in order to raise conceivable doubt and create the illusion of reasonable doubt.
I think before I let you leave, Chris, after this incredible and thought-provoking conversation, is when you think back at that young man having that year in that haunted cottage outside of Oxford, in your younger years, and the journey you've been on since, how do you think he would view where you've got to right now?
What, you mean myself as a student?
Yes.
Huh. Hard to say, of course. pleasantly surprised, I suppose. It wasn't something that I ever gave a lot of thought to. I mean, I had heard of England described as the Haunted Isle, but I'd never really thought about it. I was intrigued by the idea, but again, I had other things to think about and other things to do. I suppose it would be fascinating.
Absolutely, and I suppose, as with anything, as your body of work suggests, you've just simply followed the evidence.
That's right. Hmm. I was an open-minded, a genuine skeptic.
Yes, as we should all be. Look, Chris, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time. It's been fascinating. I could sit here and listen to you explain these theories and your research and the cases for the rest of the weekend, probably. It's remarkable having time to converse with you on these matters. Where can everybody find this book, your previous works, and keep up to date with whatever you're researching?
Well, if they want to learn more about the book, I suppose the best place to start would be my publisher's website, Llewellyn. As I said earlier, they can find description of the book, endorsements, and they can read that essay that I told you about. It's a short essay which summarizes my opinions, my perspective, and if they like that, they can then purchase the book directly through Llewellyn, or they can go to Amazon or Goodreads, or if they like, they can shop, as I do, in a fine brick-and-mortar bookstore such as Barnes & Noble.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes for everyone. And I just want to say thank you for taking the time to talk through the book and your work and some of the cases included in it. It's been fascinating spending some time in your company, and I thank you deeply for your time.
Well, thank you for having me, Paul.